This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Farm work is dangerous. It is particularly dangerous for children who work on tobacco farms. A new report by Human Rights Watch criticizes U.S. laws that permit child labor in tobacco fields. The report shows that young tobacco farm workers in four states, including North Carolina, are exposed to nicotine, toxic pesticides, and other dangers. Researchers interviewed 141 children ages 7 to 17 who'd spent time working in the fields. And we'll talk today about some of their findings. But first, we're going to meet Neftali and Yesenia Cuello. They're sisters who started working in tobacco fields in eastern North Carolina when they were 12 and 14 years old. Yesenia is now 22. Neftali is 19. But they each spent four summers working in tobacco to support their family. And they joined us in the studio now. Neftali, Yesenia, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Don't go all quiet on me now. It's good to have you here. Yesenia, tell us about your family. You're Pink Hill, North Carolina, right?
Yeah, we're from Pink Hill, North Carolina. Well, we were originally born in California, but we moved because of different issues. And then once we started working, and we weren't working in Pink Hill, but once we started working again, I was 14 and Neftali was 12 years old. Pink Hill, North Carolina, it's very rural. It's a very small town. We're working on getting ourselves on the map. I want to say that I don't believe we've ever worked in Pink Hill, but we've worked near Pink Hill.
And so the town is like eastern North Carolina. Give us a little sense of what it's like growing up.
It's all open space. You know, my mother, a single mother raising up six kids on her own. So, you know, we kind of had to grow or like help grow each other up and, you know, mature very, very fast for our age and had to work into the fields because it was a necessity.
Well, tell us about that. How did your mother feel about you working in the fields?
Oh, my mother did not want us to go to work. She insisted on us not to go. But again, whenever you put three sisters together, you know, they don't call us Las Chicas Poderosas for nothing. So
Would you translate that for me?
The Powerpuff Girls.
Yeah.
There we go. So you insisted on going out there. And your mom was already working. So you had some to tell us about her work and what she was doing. And also give me an idea of what you thought she was doing or what you thought the work was before you actually got into the fields.
Well, I want to say, like, living in rural North Carolina, like, I believe the most fun you could have is probably running outside and playing and being in the sun and, you know, stuff like that. But I want to say whenever we would picture maybe the kind of work that my mother would do, we thought it was so easy. You know, just all you got to do is pick these little things off some plants and make it happen. But I'm telling you, that first day,
you got a free tan.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the Powder Puff Girls get into the field and that's not what it is.
No, right? It was like a reality check. Yeah. It's very, very difficult. I believe our first day we did work 12 hours from 6 to 6. It was rough.
Tell us about that first day, Neftali.
My first day, being 12, I was, I guess, more exposed and, you know, younger, vulnerable to everything else. And I got left behind a lot. I was working with a whole lot of older people and, you know, I was trying to keep up with them. And my mother went and helped me a lot of times, you know, trying to get me back up to caught up to where everybody was. But, I mean, it was so hot by the time it got to 12 o'clock. And, you know, I was fainting. My mother had to go all the way to the very beginning of a tobacco row to go get me some water. And I mean, you face a lot of risk because like if you get fired, you risk your family getting fired, just from that. So I had to keep going.
Were you aware of that at the time, kind of your first day, that you were actually putting your mother's job at risk? In that sense?
No, we didn't know a whole lot of the risk that we faced, not only with heat stress or my mother losing her job, knowing that she was the only one help supporting all these families. Well, our family, which I believe it was a family of five at the time, but now we're six. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, for a single mother, that's really hard. But we valued all the work that she did. She was very independent, which was one of the main reasons why we also started working, because we strive to be independent ourselves.
So what do you wear? Do you know? Did you know kind of what to do and what to wear when you went out the first day?
Our first day, we really just wanted to wear some tank tops. You know, you think it's going to be hot out there, you know, kind of beach kind of thing. My mother went and told us, you are wearing some baggy pants, some really long sleeves. You're wearing boots. You're wearing gloves. You're wearing a hat. I said, it's not winter. But when we got there, I saw the reason why.
So you're wearing all this stuff, and what are some of the reasons why you have to wear all that?
My mother did tell us it was hot, but we didn't take into consideration that working in the fields is a whole lot hotter than just working and playing outside. But, yeah, it was really hot. We were, I believe, the places where maybe our long sleeve and, you know, long neck shirts didn't cover, we did get burned, so you could tell. So I believe that was one of the main reasons why my mom asked us to put on all that clothes. But we were like, has she seen the weather? Has she seen how hot it's going to be?
Well, I'm also told that you really need to be wearing gloves for that kind of work.
Yeah.
Did you know that going into it? And did you know why you needed to wear gloves?
I believe the knowledge that we did have as far as wearing gloves and hats and long sleeves came from my mother, because she does have experience working in the fields. But we, like, sometimes our gloves would rip and we would want to work without them. Mom would be like, no, you know, grab another pair of gloves. But it wasn't provided for us. Like, we would have to bring our own gloves and provide everything for ourselves.
Neftali, what have you learned about why you need to wear gloves since then?
I learned the fact that, you know, especially in the mornings, you know, tobacco is wet. So you always want to wear gloves because nicotine is absorbed faster, you know, when the leaves are wet and through everything. And, I mean, it's just itself. And, like, there's different things that whenever you're cutting the suckers off, which is what we did throughout the summer, like, there's different things. You could get caught up with a snake, some really, you know, bees, anything, you know. So it's just having the protection there in case. And then there were several times they sprayed us with pesticides, but we never really knew exactly, you know, what they were, if they were harmful or anything.
I mean, did you have any sense at the time that they were, that this was probably not a good thing?
No, honestly, whenever we would get sprayed or get the drift from it, we assumed that maybe it was some fertilizer that they were spraying. We didn't find out that what pesticides were and the harms that come from them until 4 years later, whenever we actually stopped and got more involved with our youth group, PJC, or Poder Juvenil Campesino.
How did you experience it? So the first day is a rough day, you're 12 days, but now you got to work a week, right? You got to wake up the next day and you go, and then a day turns into a week. So what's a typical week like, and how do you feel at the end of a week?
Well, I can kind of talk about that just because of the fact that just for the first few days, just this year, I was also working in planting tobacco. And I want to say it's so hard to go and say how difficult it is. It's a very big struggle because I didn't know, like, how it would affect me just planting tobaccos and having to walk and the heat, and then it would start raining because there were so many storm warnings going on. But, like, we had to work throughout that time. And I would get back home and I would have, like, blisters all over my legs. And I was wondering how I was even going to be able to walk throughout the next day.
Well, you talked about not knowing all of the hazards when you started. And Neftali, I know you learned about some of those later when you got involved with a group called NC Field, right? Is that right? Tell us about that.
Well, NC Field is a nonprofit organization that helps support farm workers. It's an acronym that stands for North Carolina Focuses on Increasing Education, Leadership, and Dignity Within the Farm Worker Community. So what we do is mostly try and help close the gap in between, like, organizations that help support farm workers and actual farm workers, because a large thing that we see is that there's a language barrier there. So we try and help fill that gap.
And so you do that. Tell me how you do that now. I mean, you go into fields and talk with people. How do you reach young workers especially and tell them about some of the risks and some of the precautions they should be taking?
Well, we've worked a whole lot with Dr. Thomas Arkery with Wake Forest University School of Medicine. I actually started doing my first study with him. It was a farm worker housing project. So through the knowledge that they give us, we give to the community because we're so embedded into the community. And because Pink Hill is such a small town, it's like everybody knows everybody. So that's kind of like how we help. So it's by word of mouth. And also we have a Facebook page where we invite youth. So we put, like, information up there as well as far as, like, spreading the word.
Who hired you? Were you working with a contractor or directly with the grower in your case?
It was actually working with a contractor up until just this year when I went with my mom to work in planting tobacco that I actually worked with the farmer.
I'm wondering how much the contractor told you or your mom about, again, the precautions to take, what's being sprayed on the field, when, any of that.
I think we're supposed to receive a pesticide training, I think every 3 years or
I want to say every four years.
4 years. And we never received one, just in that. And the thing is, when we first started working, the contractor was just like, if you know how to do the job, get started.
Well, once every 4 years, I would think just at intake, like the first time you start, you should get that training then, and then 4 years later if you're still with it. But
right.
you could actually wait 3 years because the cycle wasn't up, or did you get some kind of training, or should you have gotten training the day you start?
I feel like it should be better if you get a training the day you start, because again, like using mine and Netflix experience, we worked 4 summers, 4 years straight. But if your pesticide training is delivered every 4 years, then that means me and Nephly would have never gotten that information.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, and again, 3 years late might be too late in some
ways. Exactly.
Well, I'm talking with Nephly and Yesenia Cuello. They're sisters who spent 4 years working in tobacco fields in eastern North Carolina. And the reason we're talking with them is because of a recent report by Human Rights Watch. And we are now joined by Margaret Wirth, who is a children's rights researcher with Human Rights Watch. Margaret co-authored the recent report that documents children working on tobacco farms in 4 states, including North Carolina. Those states account for 90% of the tobacco grown each year in the United States. And Margaret Wirth joins us now. Margaret, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Give us a sense of the context of this report. First of all, how did Human Rights Watch become interested in the question of children working in tobacco farms?
Human Rights Watch has done research for many years now on the dangerous conditions of work for children in agriculture, because there is a double standard in U.S. law that allows children to work at younger ages for longer hours and in more hazardous conditions on farms than they're allowed to in any other sector. So we had documented dangerous conditions for kids working in a whole range of crops and became aware of the particular risks of tobacco farming due to the nicotine in the plant and the other hazards of the work.
Let's talk about some of the existing labor laws. You talked about this kind of two-tiered system allowing for child labor in agriculture. What are the laws? What are the regulations that do govern children working in agriculture?
So under U.S. law, at the age of 12, a child can work unlimited hours on a farm of any size outside of school, as long as they have their parents' permission. And children under the age of 12 can work on small farms or family-run farms. There's no minimum age. And in contrast, in all other sectors, kids have to be 16 for most jobs. 14 and 15-year-olds can only work a few hours a day in select jobs where the conditions of their work are carefully controlled. And furthermore, at the age of 16, children in agriculture can do jobs that have been deemed particularly hazardous by the Department of Labor. And children have to be 18 to do hazardous work in any other sector. So there really is a double standard when it comes to protecting child farm workers.
What is the rationale for this? How did this become embodied in U.S. law?
The Fair Labor Standards Act dates back to the 1930s and reflects a radically different era in U.S. agriculture, a time when family farming was the predominant form of agriculture. And what we're seeing today is something really different. You know, I interviewed 12-year-old children working 50 to 60 hours a week on large commercial farms. And it's clear that these weak laws reflect a broken system that needs to be changed.
So this is not 3 or 4 kids in the family working the farm to get things done. These are fairly large operations. How many people, Margaret, would you say are working on these operations in general, say in North Carolina?
It really varies, but many of the children that we interviewed were hired by farm labor contractors or subcontractors who were hired by growers, and these growers had vast operations growing tobacco and other crops. So, you know, these really are large commercial operations that many of the children were working on.
These growers wouldn't be able to operate this with just the kids, their kids and their family. They wouldn't stay viable.
Exactly. They rely on hired labor.
So how does this – now, you talked about these child labor laws with regard to farming in the United States. How does that compare – and let's stick with tobacco-producing countries around the world.
In the United States, there's no special regulations or protections to keep children out of dangerous work in tobacco farming. And other countries have enacted laws or adopted regulations to prohibit kids under the age of 18 from working on tobacco farms. So Brazil and India are 2 examples. They both produce more tobacco than the United States each year, and both countries have laws or regulations that prohibit children under the age of 18 from working in tobacco farming, recognizing the hazardous nature of the work.
All right. Well, let's talk about your research now and what you found. You surveyed about 141 kids ages 7 to 17. What did you find?
We found that children are getting sick and suffering while working on tobacco farms in the United States. The vast majority of children we interviewed reported getting sick while they were working, with nausea, headaches, vomiting, skin rashes, irritation of their eyes and mouths, respiratory symptoms. And many of these symptoms they reported are consistent with acute nicotine poisoning or green tobacco sickness, which, as Neftali mentioned, occurs when workers absorb nicotine through their skin, especially when they're handling wet tobacco plants. We also found about half the kids we interviewed reported seeing tractors come through fields where they were working or nearby fields spraying pesticides. And they said they could, you know, breathe and smell and taste these chemicals as they drifted towards them while they were working. And we know that the pesticides applied to tobacco are known neurotoxins associated with really serious long-term health effects, especially for children whose bodies and brains are still developing.
We are talking about laws that permit children to work on tobacco farms. We're talking about it on The State of Things. Mary Wirth is with me from Human Rights Watch, a lead researcher on a report on young people working on tobacco farms. We're also talking to Neftali and Yesenia Cuello, who are sisters who worked on those farms in North Carolina. So let me ask you, Yesenia and Neftali, did you ever get sick working out in the fields, Yesenia?
I want to say that personally, I haven't gotten sick. I know that whenever I was working, I did experience heat stress, and I didn't know about heat stress until a few years later, because I was working and then all of a sudden I wasn't hot anymore. Like, everything just felt fresh. So what I didn't realize was that my body no longer could differentiate the temperature within the fields and from outside the fields, because it is much harder in the fields. So
how about Neftali, how about you?
Supposedly in saying sick, my first few days of working in tobacco, like, we got the drift of, like, pesticides, I guess, being sprayed. It smelled like stink bugs. And then, like I said, those first few days, I was pretty much just about fainting. And by the time I got home, like, I was sick for about 2 days. Just felt awful.
Margaret Wirth, tell us generally what your survey found. You told us some of the afflictions that are a result of working in the fields. What are the percentages? How many kids were getting sick?
So we found that about 3/4 of the children we interviewed got sick while they were working, and about 2/3 of the kids specifically reported symptoms consistent with acute nicotine poisoning. Those symptoms are nausea, headaches, vomiting, and dizziness typically.
And who's working in those fields demographically, to give us an idea who's out there?
The children we interviewed were overwhelmingly Hispanic or Latino, the sons and daughters of Hispanic or Latino immigrants. But many of them are citizens themselves, and a recent study from researchers at Wake Forest School of Medicine found that, I think it was 78% of child farm workers they surveyed actually were U.S. citizens. And most often the kids we interviewed lived in communities where tobacco was grown, attended school full time, and when school let out for the summer or occasionally on weekends or spring break, they would head out to the tobacco fields to work.
I'm talking with Margaret Wirth, a children's rights researcher at Human Rights Watch, who co-authored a recent report documenting children working on tobacco farms in 4 states, including North Carolina. She will stay with us as our conversation continues, but I want to thank Neftali and Yesenia Cuello, who are sisters who spent 4 years working in tobacco fields in eastern North Carolina. Neftali and Yesenia, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
There's more coming up, including reaction from the industry, so stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about a recent Human Rights Watch report documents conditions of child farm workers on tobacco farms. The report covers 4 states. North Carolina is among them. The largest domestic tobacco producer is North Carolina. We've been talking with Margaret Wirth. She's a children's rights researcher at Human Rights Watch. She co-authored the report, and then we reached out to a number of tobacco companies and farming organizations around the state to be part of this conversation. We received a few statements. We'll share those later on, but we're joined, and we're thankful to have Graham Boyd, who is the executive vice president of the Tobacco Growers Association of North Carolina. Graham, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have
you. Thank you, Frank.
So you've read the report. What's your reaction to it?
Well, and I had numerous conversations with Margaret as they were preparing it as well. And we hold a position that farmers certainly should and are instructed to abide by the law. And she went through effectively describing or outlining what the fair labor standards are. And I thought she made a good point as well about that being established in the 1930s and how our society has changed, particularly in agriculture. That was an era when probably 50% of Americans lived and worked on a farm, and the scale or scope of operation was a large farm, tobacco farm at that time was 10 to 15 to 20 acres. So it was entirely organized and operated by a family. But the scale of operation and the mechanization that has occurred, certainly that dynamic has changed. And so to the extent that there may be some lag there in relevant times, that's true in everything in society when you talk about laws, whether they become antiquated or not. But I think that, you know, they cited 141 examples. We just don't see or find, and the Department of Labor doesn't report those incidences to be, I'm not going to say that they don't exist, but we don't see that to be a rampant, widespread problem with regard to children working in labor. And when you think of children working in tobacco, when you think of that, you know, the term that comes to my mind is like sweatshop labor. You know, the shirt that I'm wearing probably was made in Bangladesh or somewhere. I don't know. My wife buys it. As long as it fits and the color's right, I put mm-hmm. it on. I don't give thought to, you know, who assembled it, but I should. I certainly should. And HRW has done work in that area to bring attention to it, and I applaud them for that. I applaud them, by the way, for if there are violations and terrible discrepancies in this area of children working in agriculture, they need to be addressed, and not just this crop. And she did a very fair job of saying agricultural crops that require labor. And so I compliment Margaret's assessment that she just made. I just want to emphasize that a 16-year-old person is still considered a child, but at the same time, they are in a transitional period where physically they're able, maybe intellectually they're able, and if they choose to want to be involved in work and develop a work ethic, you see where there's a perplexity here. Do we deny them that opportunity?
Well, let's talk about that. I want to bring in another participant in the conversation because we talked about the right and perhaps the capacity of a 16-year-old to make that choice intellectually and whether they have that right. But then there's a question of where they are in terms of human development as they grow. The report speaks to the potential dangers of green tobacco sickness and pesticide exposure. And so our question is, well, does that make a difference if you're a child or an adult? So Sarah Quant joins us now. She's a professor of public health sciences at Wake Forest School of Medicine. She spent a number of years studying both of those topics, both pesticide exposure and green tobacco sickness. And she joins us now. Sarah Quant, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
So talk about this, because you heard Graham say, look, you're 16 years old, you should be able to make a decision about that. But does it make a difference in terms of human development? You've done research on this, these kinds of exposures.
Yes. My colleagues and I have been doing federally funded research on workplace health and safety risks faced by migrant and seasonal farm workers for the past couple of decades. In particular, we've looked at pesticide exposure and green tobacco sickness. I guess the thing that I want to point out is, first of all, we're not just talking about 16-year-olds. We're talking about children as young as 7 in this report. And in the study that we did last summer in North Carolina, we had children as young as 10. So we're talking about children here. And I think even if we go up through 16-year-olds, children are not small adults. They are different. Physically, many of them are smaller. And what that means is they have a greater surface area to the amount of volume in their body, and they absorb more chemicals, whether it's nicotine, pesticides, or other kinds of environmental toxins. So they're absorbing more than our adults. They also have a faster metabolic rate, so they take more breaths per minute, they expend more energy, and they're going to be getting more toxins in their body. Their nervous systems and reproductive systems, even at the age of 16, are still maturing. So any kinds of exposures to pesticides and other toxins has a greater potential impact for young people. With smaller body size and immature musculature, they have an increased risk of injury from heavy loads, repetitive motions, and awkward postures, and all the things that go along with this kind of work. Socially, I would argue that children are immature as well. And this this is part of the problem, is that they simply don't have the depth of judgment that an adult would have. And they're much less savvy to overcome some of the things that happen with contractors in terms of being exploited financially. There are stories that come out of our work and out of work of others that they are unable to deal with unwanted sexual advances that both boys and girls experience as they're working with adults in these contexts. So I think both socially and physically, we're talking about children. They're not adults. And we need to keep that distinction clear.
Well, let me ask Graham about that. And I should make the distinction now. According to the law, you can be 12 years old. So legally, a 12-year-old can be hired. We've thrown around a lot of ages. So as young as 12, if you're 7 or 8, you shouldn't be in the field, and that's a violation. And it is true that there haven't been many violations reported, though you've talked to people who are younger. But 12 years old is the legal age. So what about that, Graham, that this has a disproportionate impact on younger people?
I would not debate any of her points. And I would hold a position that says that 7 is too young to be forced to work in any condition, in any environment, air conditioned or otherwise. I mean, obviously, you're in an outdoor environment. It's hot. I'm sitting here probably the only person in this discussion who knows what green tobacco sickness feels like, because I suffered from it, you know, in the periods of my youth that she's describing. Now, yesterday was my birthday. I won't tell you how old I am today, but I will tell you that I turned 16 years old on that anniversary. And didn't get my driver's license because I was picking cucumbers, and that's a worse job than a tobacco field. So it's not just this one specific crop. Largely, I think mine was attributed to heat stress, dehydration, and factors of that kind. But I was one of those young people that grew up working in tobacco and still am involved in it, where it bothered me. Green tobacco, we called it the mean green, you would be nauseated, but hey, I would recover from it, rehydrate. And I would go back into the field. And again, I was never forced to do that. But I grew up, again, I understand the difference in that, you know, I'm native born, Beaufort County, North Carolina, et cetera. And I see the differences. But, you know, and I'm a father of three teenage children today who are 14, 15, and 17. And they are, you know, on occasion on the farm environment, have worked in tobacco, and at a young age would be out there, not all day, and I understand the differences that the report points out here, but I want them to, three things that I think are incumbent upon me as a parent, and I think the parental part of this is important to remember when we talk about any age youth working in any circumstance or any kind of productive environment. Look, I got to make sure they have a moral principle, which is no right from wrong leadership. I want to make sure they have a valuable, high-quality education. And the third thing is a quality of work ethic, you know, the value of money, a task, a chore, getting something done. And it's my responsibility to make sure they learn those things. And that's a value that comes from working in agriculture, especially for those who grew up, you know, in a farm environment, in a farm scenario.
We talked about the changes, and I wonder, knowing what we know now, knowing about the dangers of some of these pesticides, which might not have even been clear to you when you were growing up, and also, again, the way the farm has changed from family operations to large-scale contractors, you know, we've made a lot of adjustments. Thank God I don't do everything I did when I was a child. And my parents permitted things that now they wouldn't do because they know better. And I'm wondering if you think the law should exhibit those same moral principles and high consciousness that you think parents should and change.
I think we need to pause when we talk about do we legislate these things. I would tell you that any farmer who is employing or forcing a child, and a child being under the, I'm going to use the term 16, and a teenage capable of going to work at the age of 16, whether it's fast food restaurant or, you know, or on an agricultural setting, that's just inherently that should be wrong. It shouldn't be allowed. And these people should. That's my counterpoint to the report, is that we just don't see this happening. I'm not going to be naive and say that it doesn't. Just saying that you and I was, you know, there are laws about drinking and driving, but somebody's out there on the highway today violating that law. So we can't stick our head in the sand and say with absolute certainty it doesn't occur. But when it does occur, it's against the law, and there's a procedure and a process by which, you know, it should be dealt with. And dealt with in a correct fashion. I share the concerns that are brought up about exposures to pesticides or toxins of this kind. Listen, that shouldn't exist. We can't condone that. The Department of Agriculture regulates the application of that product. Even the adults who apply that product have to have a license, have to be certified, have to wear protective clothing and breathing apparatuses and so forth. So we got to take that very, very, very seriously.
Well, Margaret Worth, let me ask you, how much of what's in your report addresses violations of existing regulation, and how much of it looks at the current permissions and is sort of is suggesting that perhaps those that we need to change that?
Look, almost everything we documented in our report is perfectly legal under U.S. law. So talking about violations of laws and regulations and enforcement activities by the Department of Labor, that just doesn't apply here. A 12-year-old working 60 hours a week on a tobacco farm, absorbing nicotine through his skin, is perfectly legal under U.S. law. And Graham, I hear you loud and clear about the importance of giving children opportunities to work in agriculture, to learn work ethic, but there is something different about tobacco. It is a particularly hazardous crop due to the nicotine in the plant, the toxicity of the pesticides that are applied to it, and the children we talk to are getting poisoned by these chemicals while they're in the field. U.S. laws have recognized the importance of protecting kids from nicotine exposure. A child under the age of 18 can't walk into a convenience store and buy a pack of cigarettes. But it's perfectly legal for these kids to be out there in tobacco fields absorbing nicotine through their skin and getting sick from it. And it is absolutely time for the law to change.
Sarah Quant, can I ask you about what we know about the long-term impact of these kinds of exposures?
Well, there are two particular exposures I think we should talk about. One is nicotine and the other one is pesticides. The long-term exposures to nicotine are not well known. But what we do know is to nicotine absorbed through the skin, let me say. What we do know is that nicotine is a stimulant. And these are young people whose nervous systems are still developing, whose brains are still developing, and there are real questions about what it means to have these large boluses of stimulants going into their bodies. I would say that probably the other part of this is nicotine poisoning resulting in nausea and vomiting and just enhancing the risk of heat illness. And heat illness is responsible for most of the work-related fatalities that we see in North Carolina in the summer in farm workers. The other issue is pesticides. I think the science is much clearer there, that the pesticides that are used throughout the production process in tobacco, many of them are neurotoxins. That means they're toxic to the nervous system. And we don't experiment with pesticides in humans. But what we do know from observational studies of individuals exposed to pesticides is that children who have been exposed in utero and in early years to pesticides have lower IQs than do children who are not. We know that there is accelerated cognitive decline in adults who were exposed to pesticides. And so when we start with children who are 10, 12 years old and start exposing them to pesticides when they are still maturing, their nervous system, their brain are still maturing, they have that many more years of being exposed to these toxins to develop the kinds of cognitive decline, lower IQ, and those sorts of things that have been seen in observational studies.
Margaret Worth, Graham Boyd is here. He's Executive Vice President of the Tobacco Growers Association. Your report addresses primarily tobacco companies and not growers. Can you tell us about that choice?
Yes, we believe that companies that purchase tobacco grown in the United States have responsibilities to adopt clear policies that get kids out of dangerous work on farms and their supply chains. The largest tobacco companies in the world are buying tobacco grown here in the United States, and we're calling on them to adopt clear policies saying kids can't do hazardous work on farms where we buy tobacco. We want to see them communicate those rules to growers and make sure that growers follow those rules to make sure that kids are protected.
We had some statements from a couple of them. Reynolds Tobacco said, and I'm reading part of their statement, the issue of whether existing laws go far enough to regulate work conditions for those under 18 is complex. The Multilateral Farm Labor Practices Group is convened and working group, and it's considering this issue and others related to workers under 18. And R.J. Reynolds fully intends to participate in the group's efforts. Philip Morris was cited in your report, Margaret, as sort of being in the lead. Am I right about that, in the vanguard of at least trying to protect young workers?
Philip Morris International has the most comprehensive child labor policy of any of the companies we engaged through this research. They have a specific definition of what constitutes hazardous work, and they do prohibit kids from doing many of the tasks that we found children doing. Their policy is not as comprehensive as we would like, but it's the best that there is at this point.
I only have 30 seconds left. Margaret, what would you like to see happen?
We want to see tobacco companies work with growers to get children out of hazardous work on tobacco farms in their supply chain. And we also want to see the Obama administration take regulatory action to keep kids out of tobacco farming. This is dangerous work, and they need to be protected from it.
Same 30 seconds for you. What would that do to the tobacco
industry?
Well,
hey, the ultimate solution for us is to evolve the industry to the point where there's no labor requirement, where human hands don't touch the tobacco, and we have moved tremendously forward in that direction. Over 50% of the harvest today is done mechanically. These young ladies who were on here before, I mean, we've removed people from the field from touching the tobacco, and that is the complete solution in time.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Graham Boyd, Executive Vice President of the Tobacco Growers Association. Margaret Wirth is Children's Rights Researcher at Human Rights Watch. She co-authored the report that we've been talking about. Sarah Quant, Professor of Public Health Sciences at Wake Forest School of Medicine. All of you, thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Megan Modafferi, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and our Charlie Shelton's our intern. Robin Copley's our technical director. Brent Wolf is the news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.